My guest today, Ronald Wright, is an unusual combination of successful novelist and nonfiction writer, with at least 8 books to his credit over the past 20 years. They began with Stolen Continents, The New World Through Indian Eyes, published in 1993, which was hailed then as the best single history of the American conquest, as it gave voice to the voiceless, of which the great Iroquoian writer Eduardo Galeano asked, "Do you want to know how American Indians discovered Europe? Read this book," as I plan to do. This was followed by a scientific romance, a novel in 1999, Time Among the Maya, Travels in Belize, Guatemala, and Mexico in 2000, A Short History of Progress in 2005, Stolen Continents, 500 Years of Conquest and Resistance in the Americas, also in 2005, What is America? A Short History of the New World Order in 2008, An Illustrated Short History of Progress the same year, and Cut Stones and Crossroads, A Journey into the Two Worlds of Peru in 2009. Ronald Wright lives in Vancouver, British Columbia, where I reached him a moment ago. Welcome, Ronald Wright, to Takes on the World.
Good to be here. Good morning.
I'm very, very, very happy to have you with us. We have a lot to get into today, but I want to begin with a subject that is very much on the mind of many of our listeners. In your lengthy interview with Chris Hedges earlier this month, you spoke of your concern about the collective failure of our species to respond to climate change. On Monday, President Obama spoke as if he is now serious about confronting the subject, which both he and Mitt Romney avoided on the campaign trail, while boasting about the increased production of fossil fuels during his first 4 years in office. Obama was speaking about the increase in oil extraction from domestic tar sands that, as some domestic oil experts predicting, the U.S. will soon become a dominant player in the global fossil fuel market, thus accelerating the problems caused by climate change. Can he and we have it both ways?
You mean can we up production and deal with climate change?
Yeah, that's what he seems to be telling us at different times.
Yeah, I know. I think politicians definitely always want to have it both ways. But, of course, nature isn't quite as forgiving as that. And, there's now really no question that the carbon emissions are storing up problems for the future. And, in fact, we're already beginning to feel the problems right now. I just heard something on the news this morning that the insurance claims in North America, the leading cause of them is no longer things like fires, but is weather events, roofs being blown off, stuff like that. So that's a real indicator of how we're not simply just gradually warming the place up, which, to people living in Canada, doesn't sound so bad, but we are destabilizing the climate. And one of the sobering thoughts I sometimes have is that really the whole development of civilization from the discovery of agriculture after the last ice age, which ended maybe 10,000 years ago, roughly that. All of that has been possible because of a relatively flat line on the world's climate. It hasn't fluctuated during this past 10,000 years nearly as much as it normally does. So in destabilizing it, we may very well be bringing about an end to the conditions in which we can produce predictable food supplies and things like that. And, of course, I don't need to to tell you what the consequences of that would be.
Well, you have written about this in the past. You've gone through civilizations that have arisen, and you write about after they've reached the top, they've done the most they can do, they suddenly start to disintegrate, and things that were done that were considered progressive innovations end up having dark sides that help to cause the demise of that civilization. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Well, in A Short History of Progress, which actually was published here in 04, and it was the Canadian Broadcasting Massey Lectures that year, I came up with the term progress trap for something which starts off as a very good or at least a very seductive idea, something that makes life easier for people, but which when it reaches a certain scale or goes on for a certain length of time becomes a dead end and in fact can lead to disaster. And there have been many examples of these things. I mean, one of them I point to in the book is the development of irrigation by early civilizations, especially those in what is now Iraq, the Sumerians. You know, they came up with this great idea, irrigation. They can feed more people, build bigger cities, expand their populations. But what they didn't know is that they were making their land saltier and saltier, little by little. And it took hundreds of years, but eventually it got to the point where they said their fields were turning white. And it became so saline that large areas that were then extremely fertile are still deserts today. And so the very thing that built that civilization destroyed it. That's one example of a progress trap. Another one would be nuclear weapons, you know, where when you make a better gun, you get ahead and you dominate other people or you kill more game. But when you make a weapon that is so terrible you can never use it, then you've reached the dead end of a progress trap.
How about the issue of nuclear power without the weapons, the trying to dispose of fuel rods that have been used and are not useful for producing power but are radioactive?
Well, nuclear waste, of course, is a huge problem and is the Achilles heel of nuclear power. I'm not an advocate for nuclear power at all, but against that we have to consider what the other options are. And the waste products from burning coal and oil are probably more pervasive in the long run. Nuclear waste is a horrible thing to have around. I actually once lived in a town where there was nuclear waste, but it is relatively localized compared to carbon emissions. I don't know which is worse. It's all a matter of the scale, again, how many power stations powered by one thing or another. But what both of these things point to is that we've got to find other ways of generating power, and also we've got to make do with much less. I mean, we in North America, both Canada and the States, and I think Canadians are probably even worse, use twice as much energy as Europeans. But we're not twice as happy. We don't live twice as well. We are simply wasteful.
Well, I don't know about Canada. I've not been to Canada. But, for example, the public transportation in the United States was deliberately attacked and essentially put in mothballs at the end of World War II to expand the highways and the automobile. And the country hasn't recovered. People still believe that they need to use their automobile even when public transportation is available. And there are many areas, like in the county where we live, public transportation is a joke. And in similar areas in Europe, up in the mountains, you will find buses running regularly and people using them. It's part of their life.
Yes, that's one reason for the big difference in energy use. This is another example, really, of a progress trap, because North American cities developed mainly in the 20th century. Population expanded enormously during the 20th century. And because of the automobile and the infrastructure and the cheap gas, encouraged these sprawling types of cities with low density. And whereas in Europe, the cities are mainly much older than that and began in the horse and buggy era, and so are much more dense. It's true that, you know, North Americans did very little with public transportation, but we're also locked into a kind of settlement pattern, a kind of sprawling urban mess that is extremely difficult to provide public transport for, because you just don't have the density, and you have, you know, if you have stations, many people would have a very long way to walk to get to those stations and so forth. This is not an easy problem to solve. It's fairly easy to solve in a place like New York, but not easy to solve in places that have grown up with the automobile.
Now you're talking about all the wonderful additions that humans have made in making a human life more, supposedly more livable, not for everyone, of course, on the planet. You also speak about the growing gap between rich and poor, which shows no sign of lessening. But even I was thinking of the social media we have, in which people have become addicted to all these little toys that get smaller and larger, that they can do everything they need to do on without having to think. That people even have lost the ability now to do addition mathematics in their head because they don't need to. They have a little toy, a gizmo, that does that for them. And I'm curious to see how your feeling is about social media on this whole question of our future.
Well, I'm of the generation that grew up before social media, so I don't really get a lot of it. I mean, I'm not on Facebook, and I don't bother with Twitter. I have enough demands on my time without, constantly checking these things to see what other people are doing and what they think about something I did. So, I'm pretty old-fashioned in that way. On the other hand, I do find the web very useful for certain kinds of research, as long as you cross-check carefully, because a lot of the information out there is not reliable. But I do use it. And it's certainly convenient to be able to send a manuscript to your publisher as an electronic file instead of a huge wad of papers, and in some ways maybe more environmentally responsible. But I do worry about what this instant gratification and also constantly being in contact is doing to the way people think, and particularly the way young people's brains may be developing, because the ability to plan ahead seems to be gone, and the ability to, if somebody sends me an email, I might not answer it for several days, and I will think about it. But I think there's a tendency for this whole thing to speed up. People expect a reply, within an hour, and then they send you another email back, and then you've got to reply to that one. On it goes. And this doesn't give people time for reflection. It doesn't give people time to, say, spend a whole day with a book or... I think it may be getting us into that sort of lab rat mindset of constant gratification, amusing ourselves to death to pinch somebody else's book title.
Well, I found this true in the schools here, talking to students who admit that they cannot stand to hear silence, that they have to be listening to music. They don't love music any more than your generation and our generation. But they constantly need to be listening to something, and they do not have time or even consider reflecting. And using the term reflection was very interesting, because everything is rushed. I'm often disturbed myself when I send an email out and I get an immediate reply. That somebody is just sitting there waiting for my email to come in and get a reply, and I'm the same way as well. I sometimes will sit on an email and think about replying, and don't want to get into a conversation that could be done on the telephone if you want to do it immediately. So I understand that problem. It also eliminates the reflection about actually what is happening to our world.
Well, yes, we're being so distracted by all our appetites and entertainments that sports, another one. That's been around a long time, but that's another one. We worry about what the ball team is doing or something, instead of worrying about what sort of world our kids and grandkids are going to have. And that we are losing the ability to think ahead. And we actually, ironically, the computer gives us, for certain kinds of studies anyway, very good ways of modeling and dealing with highly complex data that one individual couldn't possibly master in order to make some informed guesses about where things are going. And it's, of course, partly because of this technology that we have these projections for the degrees to which the climate is going to warm. And admittedly, it's a big window between the sort of low estimate and the high estimate. But really, any warming is not going to be good, anything certainly above a degree or so. So it gives us this ability to look ahead, but we as a species are very bad at looking ahead. And, it goes right back to when we evolved as Ice Age hunters, as people chasing down mammoths and stuff like that. And you can see it in the past that, people got so good at hunting that they learned how to drive a whole herd of mammoth or a whole herd of buffalo over a cliff and ate like kings. But then pretty soon there's no more mammoths around. And this is exactly what we're doing with our huge appetite for resources. It's not mammoths anymore, but we are using up the fish in the sea. We are polluting the oceans and the air. I mean, I don't need to go over it again. So what we need is a transition to long-term thinking. We need, number one, to wake up and realize that we are perhaps, that this decade and the next one may be the last time when there's a chance to change our way of life and make it something that will endure. And, you know, I'm all in favor of civilization. I want it to last. I don't want to go back and live in a cave. And that's not an option anyway for 7 billion people. You know, when we lived primitively, we lived in very small numbers. And even as recently as 1820, before the steam engine really took hold, there were only 1 billion people in the world, which is about as many as you can support using traditional non-industrial agriculture. So we're now 7 billion, and we've got to figure out how we can avoid a really horrible death for most of those 7 billion at some point in this century. And the only way to do that is to make sure that there's enough for everyone to go around. And that's why I point to the gap between rich and poor, because if you allow the upward concentration of wealth, it guarantees there never will be enough to go around. And we see a gap between rich and poor now that is greater than at any time in history. It's worse than France just before the French Revolution. It's worse than the difference between the pharaoh of Egypt and the guy dragging the stones. It is absurd. There's now more people living in abject poverty, below $1.50 a day, than the entire population of the Earth at the beginning of the 20th century. That's not progress.
It certainly is not. You also write about the belief and you go use it to 500 years, the discovery and pillage of the New World, and you go into that, but you talk about the experience of a relatively easy 500 years expanding and colonizing and taking over new lands that had led to the modern capitalist myth that you can expand forever. And
yes.
And we've reached the end, no?
Yeah, I think we've reached the end of an extraordinary 500-year period that I called in what is America, I called it the Columbian Age, but it doesn't really matter what we call it. But it was a time when an entire hemisphere of the planet was up for grabs by Europeans. And, of course, I'm talking about here in North and South America. And the very lucky, the thing that made it so lucky for Europeans was that it was not a wilderness. That people had been living here and developing civilizations and crops and various kinds of wealth, especially gold and silver, for thousands of years, just as long as people had on the other side of the Atlantic. But because of the vulnerability of the American populations to mass killers such as smallpox, which had not reached the Americas before, and for various reasons there wasn't anything equivalent to that in the Americas, suddenly you've got the kind of thing that the neutron bomb was supposed to do. You've got something that kills most of the people but leaves everything, all the wealth and the infrastructure behind. And, you know, that goes right back to the Pilgrim Fathers. They when they landed on Plymouth Rock, they went there not because it was a wilderness where they could settle and do their thing in peace. They went there because they'd heard that the Wampanoags had been wiped out by smallpox. And this is the middle of the winter. And there are houses, there are stores of corn and other winter vegetables, and there are fields already prepared for planting, and the owners have all died, so they move in. So the expansion of Europe and then the settlers who came from Europe has been an essentially parasitic process on this half of the world that had developed in isolation before that.
My guest is Ronald Wright. We're talking about the future of the planet, short history of progress in the past of the planet. And you go into in some detail about how the Industrial Revolution, the economies, the wonderful rich economies of Europe were built on the backs of the indigenous people here who were killed or died of disease, and their resources were taken and sent back to the mother country to produce the kind of economy we have today, essentially.
Well, yeah, essentially we had this time when Europeans were in the right place at the right moment, and there was a feedback that the discovery not only of the gold and silver, I mean, but both Karl Marx and Adam Smith, the founding sort of thinkers of both Marxism and capitalism, both pointed to the wealth of the Inca and Aztec civilizations as being the startup money for the Industrial Revolution. It took quite a while for it to change from being, Spanish loot into steam engines, but that was when the process really took off, because there was the money to develop new technologies, largely stimulated by wars, of course, especially the Spanish Empire's efforts to control the world. And then at the same time, even more important than that, gold and silver was the food crops. Suddenly, you've got both cold weather crops like potatoes, temperate crops like corn, and then tropical crops like the sweet potato and manioc, which spread around the world and which, for various reasons, were much more productive than the crops of the old world. They gave about twice the yield for half the work. So suddenly a much larger population could be supported. And then you've got the population of the Americas dwindling, largely because of disease, but also, of course, because they're constantly being pushed to the wall by murderous invaders. And you've also got, with these new crops, you've got the European population expanding very fast, and you've also got the African population expanding very fast. And the Europeans figured out that they could capture the Africans, and there were people in Africa willing to sell their own people as foreign exchange, and then take them to the New World and put them to work in these lands that had been emptied by the plagues that wiped out their original owners. So that sort of pump going across the Atlantic, that interchange of crops, money, and land and people, led to this 500 years of great expansion and prosperity for some people, mainly Europeans and people of European descent in North America. And I think that fostered an idea that everything was always going to get bigger and better, and that the world would always be a land of opportunity, and that there would always be, each generation would always be more prosperous than the one before. And, that was true for centuries, that was what was happening if you were a person of the right color in the right place. But, of course, it's no longer true. There are no more empty continents. There are no more undiscovered miracle crops. In spite of what the GM Foods people will tell you, not one new staple crop has ever been developed. All of our crops were developed long ago in prehistoric times. We can tinker with them, but that's all we can do. There are no new staples.
And we've largely fished the oceans. Now you go into a fish market, and you see most of the fish there is what they call farm-raised.
Yes. and actually right here on the coast of British Columbia, there's a lot of that, and it's very controversial. People who live here won't eat that stuff. They're happy to sell it to other people elsewhere, but they won't touch it here. And you see signs on the bumpers here that say, wild salmon don't do drugs.
That's great. One of the things you point out, and the pessimistic pointing out pessimistic positions, is that people, the people in so-called advanced societies have this feeling that you mentioned, that we could keep on going forever, and the people collectively need to change their way of thinking, and it's very, very difficult when they have no guidance, no leadership. You look around the world today, it has to be done at every level, and particularly being at the government level. And you look at the United States today, both parties, but particularly the Republican Party, are living in another century, want to deregulate. They think deregulation is the key to saving the United States when it's nonsense.
Oh, well, you know, that has been disproved by recent history. I mean, the sort of that Friedmanite monetarist idea that you just deregulate and everyone will get so rich and it'll all trickle down and we'll all be happy. You know, I don't know why he got the Nobel Prize, Milton Friedman, because none of that was a new idea. That was simply a return to the kind of economics that we had in Victorian times. And it led to a feeding frenzy, and it ultimately led to the First World War and the Great Depression, the boom-bust thing, and then the Second World War. And, you know, that the first half of the 20th century, we learned those very painful lessons that if you just let capitalism rip, you're going to have boom-bust cycles, massive depressions. That creates a lot of people out of work. That creates extremist politics. And you're going to get things like Bolsheviks, Nazis, anarchists, and so forth. And so, you know, the consensus after the Second World War, and the United States took the lead in this, was to share things around and have regulation to even out the boom-bust cycle in economics. And, you know, from the late 1940s through to the late 1970s, that's the way the world was run, and that was a time of unprecedented prosperity. But since then, we've reverted to this sort of Victorian idea of dog-eat-dog capitalism, or at least many people advocate this. And the results are unplanned expansion of cities, which makes it impossible to put in transportation systems, and enormously widening gap between rich and poor. I mean, just an obscene gap between wealthy and poor, where, you know, the average person in the top 1%, you know, relative to the people at the bottom of the society, that's a bigger gap than between the pharaoh of Egypt and, you know, the guys dragging the stones for the pyramids. And you know, the other thing is that that doesn't work even for the rich, because it is a recipe for revolution and war. It always has been. So, you know, it may work for a short term, but none of this works in the long term.
Amen. My guest is Ronald Wright. If you have any calls, quick questions or comments for Ronald Wright, you can give us a call here at 895-2448. You've given us a lot of food for thought. Do you see any positive signs on the horizon that governments are going to be able to deal, that any governments besides talking are ready to deal with the issue in a serious way?
Well, oh yeah, I think so. I do see some positive signs. I mean, I think, for one thing, the European Union, now I know it's in some financial trouble, but the European Union was a remarkable thing. I mean, that is a sign of people learning from history. You know, these Europeans who've been trying to murder each other on a large scale for a couple of thousand years finally said, we can't go on doing this anymore. And the structure of the European Union, which is not quite a federation, but it is more than just a trading bloc, does balance the interests of business, the environment, and labor, or social issues, to a greater degree than any other such body anywhere in the world. And they have got a very aggressive carbon-cutting program. They are committed to 20% reduction from the original 1992 baselines by 2020. And they're spending the kind of money on that the U.S. was spending on the war in Iraq. It's about $90 billion U.S. dollars a year. And it's just serious money. And they have said that they will go to a 30% target if other major players will, such as the U.S., such as China would have to come into that now. But so they're leading the way with that. And they also just recently, I think yesterday, passed a tax on financial big financial transactions, a tiny tax. It's just 1.1%. But this has been proposed for many decades. It's often known as the Tobin tax, after the man who first suggested it. And the idea here is two things. One is if you put a very small tax on all the money that sloshes around the world every day, mainly for purely speculative purposes, currency speculation and so on, if you put a very small tax on that, it actually slows the thing down a bit and makes people think twice and therefore may help to prevent the kind of meltdown that we saw in 08. That's one argument. The other argument is that if the world could agree on a Tobin tax, and this is really the first time it's ever been done, but if we could expand that to include most of the developed world, we would have a way of raising money from the people who have so much money they can barely count it on an international basis. And so it wouldn't be tied to any one national government, and it could then be used to address the absolutely critical issues of poverty and environmental degradation that must be addressed on a worldwide basis, that no one country can manage on its own.
Well, we have a board lit up here. A couple of people want to call here, so let us open the phone. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having this author. I have so enjoyed. Thank you so much, Jeffrey, and thank you for being on our airwaves. I'd love to hear your analysis of the Idle No More movement and where you think it's at this point. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's an excellent question. Thank you. I think of it just as a Canadian thing because it started here, but I guess it has a world profile now. And there are really, it seems to me, to be two things driving Idle No More. One is to improve the conditions of what we call First Nations people in Canada, which would be Native Americans in the States, indigenous people, who many of whom live in terrible conditions, and to, you know, fulfill treaties that have not been fulfilled and that kind of thing. So that's one part of it. But another part, and this is something that goes far beyond just Native issues, is that we have a very, very right-wing, pro-big oil government at the moment. Our government is to the right of your government, which is not usually the way it is in Canada, but it is at the moment. And this government has, in the last two budget bills, which were much more than budget bills, has actually torn up most of the environmental protection legislation in Canada, including things that go back into the 19th century, protecting waterways, fisheries, things like that. And so there's been an all-out assault on the environment by the federal government for the purposes of massive oil expansion, mainly the infamous Alberta tar sands and the pipelines they want to build associated with that. And the indigenous people are on the front line here because they're saying if you're going to start degrading the rivers and the waterways and so forth, that is a violation of our treaties. And the majority of Canadians are in favor of protecting the environment. The polls always show that. This government took power with only 39% of the vote because of the peculiar voting system that we have. And here is a cause that Native people and people who've come more recently to Canada can unite over, which is the protection of the environment and a certain amount of social justice for everybody, especially for the people from whom this entire country was virtually stolen over the past century or two.
Well, we have another call here. I think we have to have you back on here again. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. I'm calling from inland and wanted to add something to the comments about recycling spent nuclear fuel rods, which is that's a complete fallacy about how that is stored safely or recycled. That how they're recycled is into depleted uranium weapons. And that's been a kind of a stealth operation that results in vaporization of highly radioactive material when weapons are used, which goes into the atmosphere, is breathed by people, goes on to the soil, gets put into the groundwater for more or less forever. So that should be added to the discussion about the nuclear energy option. Thank you for the wonderful guest.
Oh, thanks for a call.
Yes, well, your call is absolutely right. Of course, that is a huge problem, the weaponization of this stuff. And a lot of it was used in the Iraq War, and there is a pattern of weird birth defects and so on, and also effects on American troops from where these weapons were used. So, yeah, in that sense, I mean, I didn't say that the stuff was being recycled safely. What I said is that the waste problem from nuclear power plants is relatively localized. It is not like carbon dioxide that goes everywhere. But, of course, if you start putting it into cannon shells and firing it around the world, then you are spreading it everywhere. So, I'm glad you brought that up, caller.
Of course, we had the situation at Fukushima, which we don't know the extent of the worldwide damage that's caused. I know from what I've heard, people in Japan, there's so much cover-up of the Fukushima situation that people don't know what the truth is.
Well, there's been enough of these things now. I mean, there's been Three Mile Island, there's been Chernobyl, there's been Fukushima, and probably a few other minor ones. But there's enough of these things that, you know, nobody can really claim that this technology is safe. It is a technology that's barely under control, and probably a very unwise option. Also, I think the idea that if we expand nuclear power plants, we can buy some time to deal with weaning ourselves off oil. That's quite an attractive idea, but it takes at least 10 years to get these things up and running, and we don't really have 10 years to mess about with an old technology that already is problematic. We need to go into new technology and also conservation. I mean, if you can cut energy use by 25% or 50%, effectively you're doing the equivalent of building thousands of power stations, and you're doing it in the best possible way, which is not having to build them.
Ronald, I have to. I see the clock is coming to the end of the hour. It's a good way to end it. We all need to do what we can do to save the planet. Ronald White, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Listeners, go to his website. It's Ronald Wright, WRIGHT, one word, ronaldwright.com. And you can see what books he's written. And I do want to have you back. Thank you very, very much for a very enlightening morning.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. All the best.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.